lot of you have heard me tell this story, but there's a, those of you who know me know I'm kind of an energy geek, and there's a very well-known energy writer who lives here in Austin. His name is Robert Price, and he and I exchange emails and notes and articles back and forth. So I got an email, and he's making, actually, if you have a few minutes, not while we're speaking, of course, there's a website called juicethemovie.com, and that Robert's got this feature film coming out about the development of electricity from the very beginning. But anyway, he went all over the world looking at how people generate electricity and what it does to their standard of living. So he sends me an email from Iceland, and he had just gotten there from Lebanon, where they're all living off of generators because of the wars. But in Iceland, they have the large, because they're sitting on a volcano, right? So all the power is generated by thermal energy. So it's a very low-cost electricity. And the nation of Iceland is being overrun by Ethereum mining, cryptocurrency mining factories. And
because electricity is so cheap.
Yeah, and as Peter says, it's not some kid on his laptop in Starbucks. These are like factories,
right,
with banks and banks and banks of computers, and the power that they consume is shocking, no pun intended. So much so that the president of Iceland is trying to cut down on some of these cryptocurrency miners coming into Iceland because even though they've got virtually unlimited power supply, it is taxing their infrastructure. And the cost of it's interesting because the cost of creating a coin, a bit of virtual currency, is primarily electricity and computing
right.
cost. And it's these calculations across the blockchain, which are distributed, I guess they can be distributed all over the world, is so expensive that it's not, it's not all profit. There's actually quite a bit of cost produced in coming up with some algorithm that presumably cannot be replicated without the key.
Right. Okay, so let's look at the most authoritative source in the world, that is Wikipedia. And I'm saying that a little tongue in cheek because everybody relies on it. But just a point of fact, Wikipedia started in 2001, now has over 2.5 million articles, and the Encyclopedia Britannica started in 1765 and has 250,000 articles. So we're looking at something that probably is authoritative. This is a pretty good definition about in relying on some kind of source of information about containing this information, and I mentioned earlier about the hash totals and timestamps. But how this actually works in terms of just connecting things is that if there's a block of data that is created and it's validated through this process we had been talking about, then that particular block is connected to the block before it and the block after it, so that if there's any kind of change and somebody was to try and spend the money twice, then it would show up because then all the hash totals would no longer operate properly. So part of this is, where do you get this? Where do you get the cryptocurrency? And we looked at an initial coin offering, which we're going to talk some more about, exchanges, and also peer-to-peer, so that there are different ways to get it. But we look at headlines like this with the SEC not liking ICO so much. And I think that, as a matter of fact, I saw a blog yesterday about the fact the SEC is trying to come up with some guidelines to deal with this.
Yeah, what's interesting about this is courts and the administrative agencies are trying to figure out and as bankruptcy lawyers, we need to figure out what exactly a cryptocurrency coin or collection of coins is. Is it stock? If it's a security, it has to be perfected under Article 8, and there's some very specific rules for doing that. If it's a general intangible, then we're looking under Article 9. If it's actually treated as currency, then you either need to have some sort of deposit account control agreement or possession of the key. And we could talk about the crypto key in a little bit, but this is, if you're a trustee, if you're a judge, if you're a bankruptcy lawyer representing a debtor or a creditor, the control of that key and how the cryptocurrency is accumulated is very important, not only from a security standpoint, but from a valuation standpoint, and from a standpoint of simply controlling assets of the estate.
So part of it is we're going to see more headlines, I think, on the impact of the ICO, obviously. But then where do you keep this cryptocurrency? How do you deal with it? And this is not such an easy mechanism, because even though we call it a digital wallet, as John pointed out, is if you don't have the key, you may not be able to find it.
Right. And how is the key kept, Peter, physically?
Well, actually, going back into the early 90s, there was something called a public key infrastructure, where someone has a private key, and then there's also a public key. And so this is actually, one more time, this is nothing new. It's just a new means by which it's being utilized. And I think part of the issue is that because it's internet-based and it's not government-regulated, it becomes much more confusing. And then we also have countries that are trying to regulate this. Canada, the UK, and China have all established mechanisms by which they hope they can get into the cryptocurrency business so that it can be part of their monetary system. I don't know if that's going to work too well.
Well, think about it from the standpoint of a sovereign nation.